Agile Attilia podcast listeners, welcome to the first episode of the year. I hope 2021 finds you well and ready for some fascinating topics and guest speakers that we have in store for you for this new year. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Niels Flaeging on the topic of organizational complexity and living systems. Niels offers thought-provoking, conceptual, and radical ideas as a speaker, while helping organizations with triggering, mapping, and leading profound and robust change initiatives as a highly effective advisor. Niels is the author of 7 books, including Leading with Flexible Targets, Beyond Budgeting in Practice, which was awarded the Financial Times Germany Best Business Book Award, and his latest book, Essays on Beta Volume 1, What's Now and Next in Organizational Leadership, Transformation, and Learning. In this episode, we start off by chatting about how organizations and its leaders can move beyond command and control patterns and towards decentralization without a predominantly centralized steering approach, like in a market economy. Niels gives examples of how practices within frameworks like Scrum and Kanban have been wrongly placed next to command and control practices. We then explore the cell structure design, which is central to Niels's transformation work, and the differences between central cells and periphery cells. Finally, we wrap up the episode by discussing open space beta, time boxing organizational development, traditional change management, like Cotter's, communities of problems, and organizational hygiene. This conversation with Niels has been personally quite thought-provoking, and it really gives me a lot of new and, to a certain extent, radical ideas to explore. I can't think of a better guest to start the new year with. Please enjoy. Hi, Niels. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Hi, Raul. Thanks for inviting me. I'm good. It's a cold day in Germany, but as you know, as you are also in Germany, not the best time of the year in Germany.
Yeah, and before we jump into today's topic of organizational complexity and living systems, I'd love for you to briefly tell us about your background and how you came into, you know, working and doing research and writing books in this field of something like organizational complexity.
Yes, I was I studied business administration in economics in Germany, and then I started working in Brazil. I moved to just like you living abroad. I wanted to live abroad too for a couple of years. That mattered to me. So I moved to Brazil and started working as a financial controller. I was a marketing guy originally during university, but in Brazil I started working with the numbers, and which was a good opportunity to learn, I thought. It was also incredibly Excel, say, dominated the work. But I did that for a couple of years, like 5 years I was a financial controller. First in pharmaceutical industry, then in a conglomerate, ThyssenKrupp, which is a famous company in Germany, as you know. And during that time as a financial controller, I did a lot of planning and budgeting and reporting work and cost management and that kind of stuff. All the kinds of things that finance people do, right? And at Boehringer Ingelheim, my first company in Brazil, we suffered enormously from these currency fluctuations and volatility at the time. So we had to do to keep the reporting up to date, we had to redo the planning all the time. 1 year, maybe 2000 or so, we did probably 7 or 11 plan versions. So we replanned all the time. It was really, really crazy. And all that with Excel, lots of sheets. Large companies, or lots of Excel sheets, gigabytes, if I remember well. So it was horrible. And we then started using top-notch IT systems to do the planning and reporting, but still nothing improved. So even though we started using the cool data cube systems that were available in the marketplace at the time, and web-based budgeting and planning, nothing improved. And at the time, I found out about a movement from England, the Beyond Budgeting Roundtable, that was started to write in 1999 about companies that didn't have any plans or budgets or annual cost figures, allocations at all. And at first, I thought that was lunacy.
Sounds crazy.
Lack of control. Yeah. Anarchy. Yes. it's like when, as a software developer, you get in touch with Scrum or, let's say, Agile for the first time, and you intuitively say that cannot work. That's complete bullshit, bogus. They are lying to us, you know. So I had this kind of epiphany, of course, after a while, and I started talking about beyond budgeting and doing no planning and decentralization and getting beyond command and control. I started talking about that at conferences, and over time I thought about writing. I wrote articles about it, and then I was asked to publish a book in Germany about it. And I did that in 2003 and started my own company. And since then, for 17 years now, I have been doing this full time, talking about moving beyond command and control, let's say agile organizations, full-fledged agile organizations. That has been my topic for 17 years. And I've also always been helping organizations to do it, to do the transformation.
Yeah, amazing. That's a great story. Thanks for sharing. I guess a lot.
Thank you for asking me. I do not tell the story so often anymore.
Yeah, no,
it's so long ago. Oh boy, he was a finance manager 17 years ago. What does it mean? I'm old. I'm 49 years old. So
I mean, it's also, I guess, for people to think and consider, you know, who are also still using the planning, the Excel, the traditional form of budgeting. That was 17 years ago that you came to this realization, and people are kind of still, you know, doing that way in some organizations.
Yes. Shockingly, overall, I think by and large, shockingly little has stuck. And to see the agile movement, if I may say so, if I may say, include you in that and myself in that, when I see now our movement falling back into command and control habits and promoting command and control tools and practices, that is shocking to me. You know, all this scaling, all this, you know, the dominance of agile coaching in the world, it's no good ultimately. It's obviously a fall back into command control. Also OKRs and all this technocratic, bureaucratic, hipster agile bullshit, as I like to call it. it's like the empire striking back. You know, agilists are being sucked back into command and control. And I think we hardly liberated teams at all. I doubt that most Scrum teams are actually doing Scrum in a way that can be called self-organized. So I think we've got a long path ahead of us. And my work has always been about liberating entire organizations from command and control and transforming entire organizations, not just teams. And I think that's the doom of Agile, so to say, that we have for too long. Agilists have looked at teams, and now these team approaches and also team successes that they have been fading away again, fizzling out.
You talk about, you know, this focus on the team, on the more tactical side of things. Whereas, you know, if you do start off with looking at the entire system, right, you can sort of see the bigger context, right, the larger scale of it or the larger effects of it. So, yeah, I want to ask you about living systems, right? And I definitely do want to come back to the command and control topic, but I'd like to start off with touching on, you know, living systems. What are they, and why is it important to think of where we work as living systems?
Well, living systems, and this is something that was natural to me as a finance guy, just as any software developer, you know, agilist. I think you have to learn about certain facets of work and organizations that we haven't studied or haven't heard about naturally from the work, or, you know, that we don't know. We have to be students of how organizations function. I had to study complexity theory, psychology, social psychology, also the science of change, if one could call it like that. So I really digged into that very deep. And if you ask me about living systems, I think the most important thing to understand is that command and control is not about living systems at first. I mean, every organization is a living system, but in management, in organizational sciences, we have long ignored the nature of living systems and also the nature of human work and collaboration, which is where concepts like waterfall, which doesn't really exist, which is just a consequence of Tayloristic command and control and the division between thinkers and doers and the steering that comes with dividing an organization into functional parts. You know, that's where all the testing departments and so come from. We have long ignored the basic fundamentals of complexity and complex systems, or living adaptive systems, or however you might. Now it's time to get to that. And what complex living systems must be if they have to survive in complex markets is they must be decentralized. And that is a lesson that too few people have, too many have failed to grasp yet. Whenever markets are complex, and they have been, markets have been complex since the 1970s or 80s, everywhere in the world, except of course the Soviet Union, but then starting in the 1990s, everywhere in the world, with complex markets, organizations must decentralize and reunite the thinking with the doing, just like what Toyota did in the 1950s and 60s. Only then can we be, you know, competitive, and can we end the suffering that comes with command and control.
Yeah, so we've talked about decentralization, a bit of change. You touched on these keywords, but complex organizations and complex systems, when you say that, what are you referring to? So I'd love to hear you describe what makes something complex or living.
Well, complexity is natural to organizations, just as it's natural to human beings. If we were complicated, we would be dead, a dead corpse. That's a complicated system. It's not alive. The connections between the parts do not change by itself. Worms get into the game and so on, and insects. But, a living system, a living person, a living biological system, a market, a society, a group, a team, a group, a society, the political sector, and so on. All that, those are markets, they are living systems. And living systems, of course, they must be adaptive. They are not centrally steered. They are not controllable from the outside. I guess everyone listening in knows exactly what I'm talking about. A complex system can never be steered from the outside. You see that in children. You cannot control them from the outside. Even with incentives, ultimately, you cannot steer them. Same happens to teams, to markets, to societies, and so on. So organizations as social living systems, they should not be steered from the inside, which is what practices like OKRs, targets, fixed targets, budgets, annual plans, strategic planning, and that kind of stuff does, or also waterfall project planning methods. So all this centralized steering that's going on in an organization, including practices like performance appraisal and so on, plan actual variance reporting, all this stifles organizational vitality. I don't want to preach to the choir here because I think these things should be obvious by now, but the practices have not been eliminated. What we call organizational hygiene hasn't happened. And also the fatality of the agile movement is that we have put agile practices like, let's say, Scrum and everything that comes with it, and the Kanban boards and everything, we have put it next to the command control practices. So there's an epic battle going on between these methods. It's not that Scrum doesn't work in certain cultures. That's all just nonsensical defensive bollocks, as the British would say, because Scrum works perfectly fine, of course, but we have to create the conditions overall to make it happen. And that includes you have to abolish product management, for example. You have to abolish the line of hierarchy that tells people what to program or develop next. And that hasn't happened. The Scrum Guide always said the PO is one single person, not a group, and nobody can force the PO about what to do. And all this has been fatally, totally, utterly ignored over the last 15, 20 years. So we shouldn't be surprised that the so-called self-organizing practices and tools aren't really working. They do not stick because we haven't changed organizations by and large. Few organizations have abolished budgeting. Very few have abolished bonuses, fixed targets, and those bullshit practices. I'm sorry for using this language, but I think this is not for children anyway, right?
No, it's completely fine. I had a follow-up question for you. You mentioned, not having a centrally steered organization, department, team. Why is this bad, and how can teams and departments do this?
Whenever you create departments or let's say organizational functions or silos, when, for example, you separate the testing from, what would you have? If you have a testing department, you would separate it from the development or
Development, design, maybe, or something else.
Once you create those kinds of functions, and these are just examples, because in industry, you would divide at a certain point between sales and marketing and production and logistics and purchasing. And so it's the
Product, tech.
same. Exactly. Or the creation of HR or of IT departments. Once you create these functions and as standalone functions, let's say, you must steer them from the top through budgeting, through bosses, and command and control practices overall. And they start, of course, playing individual games. They become like fools, because they optimize themselves their own function. A real living system would not divide the functions and put walls between them, but integrate those functions into small teams. A team, sociology tells us over and over again, starts with maybe three or four people and ends with five, six, seven, eight, nine people. And then above eight or nine, it's not a team anymore. It's just a group, It becomes looser, less socially dense. So team is an intimate constellation, like an ensemble. Beautiful French word. Ensemble is a very helpful word. They can play ensemble. They can work for each other, with each other, as DM, Drogeriemarkt, the German company, says. Instead of having standalone functions and silos, we should have mini organizations, mini companies within a company that create the value. A Scrum team is naturally such a mini team or cell because it would integrate different functions that you need to develop a feature or features or minimum viable products or a product at all. So this integration of functions into small teams is like the new stuff. Even though it's the oldest thing in the world, companies, a startup is always functionally integrated like that. And to do that with a large organization, let's say you have 1,000 people or 10,000 people, and say, okay, in a 10,000 people organization, there are naturally 200 or so or a little less teams inside that should be functionally integrated. And most of them in the periphery should work as businesses serving external customers. And then there would be some central center cells that will serve the periphery so that the periphery can serve the market. That is the natural, it looks like a peach model of organizing with a center, a periphery, and the periphery being in charge. That is the lost science of complex adaptive living organizations. And of course, most organizations with their command and control pyramids are built against this model. So they depend, command and control organizations, functionally divided organizations depend on centralized steering, while decentralized or beta organizations, as I call them, they let themselves be steered from the outside, from the market.
And with these beta organizations, one of the traits that you would need is to have enough skilled talent that covers, you know, the sales, the marketing, the design, the development, etc.
Yeah. But this, you just mentioned a few disciplines. And the question is one person only capable of acting within one of these disciplines? Or is it normal that people would act in several of these disciplines? You know, the normal thing is that you can write code. Many people can conceive software features, not everyone, because that's a craft, really. But then many people can write code, many people can test, and many people can pick up the phone and talk to clients as well. So software developers naturally should be, over time, be capable of doing any of these things with more mastery or less mastery, but you know, you should be able to, over the course of a professional career, become good or appropriately good in all of these functions. And if you think about a team being 5 people, 6 people, 7 people, it's not that in the team everybody has to do everything all the time, but that the work can be shared among team members and should be shared among team members. So it's not that a decentralized organization or self-structured organization requires everyone to do everything, but we have to recognize that people can and should be multidisciplinary and not monodisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. One of the challenges
By the
that
way,
I've
I
seen...
hate what can I say about something
yeah.
I hate?
Yeah, go ahead.
I hate this bogus about T-shaped professionals. Have you heard that? Heard of that? T-shaped bullshit, that's so nasty. That's like talking about slavery. It's really one of the nastiest things. People are not T-shaped. We just should have several masteries or many masteries. And of course, when we get older and have worked longer, we develop more mastery, so profound, deep mastery. But nobody is T-shaped. That's just a nasty HR prejudice, I think, against people.
Well, yeah. So I guess one of the arguments that would come up in this debate, right, is the need for specialization. So having skilled talent as an expert that has maybe 20, 30 years of experience doing what they're doing, whether it's a sales call, whether it's development, whether it's graphic design, how do you make up for that?
That's where the bullshit sinks in. This what you just described is an opinion. And it is of the opinion that one person can only do one thing really, really well, which is just a lie. It's just fraudulent. It's not true. Real masters of any craft can do many things very well. For example, Beethoven, he was a great composer, but he was also a business person, an inventor. And he mastered several trades. We are not so much aware of that, but it's like that everywhere. If you look at really, really notoriously great people in business, especially, you see that they have mastered all kinds of crafts. So this notion that, and to be a specialist, you can only do one. You can only write in, you know, whatever Java or whatever software is, language. You must be totally specialized. That's just nonsense. People can specialize in many, many things, and they do over the course of their lives. What you just said, it's a great example of the ideologies we have created around success and mastery and performance, such as the notion. Let's talk about another one briefly. The ideology of individual performance is one of the nastiest, most enslaving dogmas on earth as well. Organizations are created because no single individual would be able to create that value by himself or herself. The reason of being of organizations is you must do things together. So, of course, in an organization, individual performance does not exist, has never existed, will never exist. Organizations, like you have never performed individually in an organization, nor have I, nor has anybody. And this notion to define individual targets, measure individual performance, give out individual bonuses, appraise people individually, it's all, that's all part of this anti-humanistic dogma. It should be dealt with in The Hague.
So I'd love to hear you describe in this cell structure with the center and the periphery and what you call the beta orgs, how is success measured for that organization?
In a decentralized cell structure organization, performance can be or should be measured for the whole organization. Let's say you lived in Texas for a couple of years, right? Mm-hmm. There are some notorious beta organizations. Southwest Airlines has maintained their beta organization for 5 decades now, right? Also, I think, what else is there? Dell was for a long time a cell structure organization. So what you can learn from these companies is you measure performance on the level of the organization or the company or the companies, if it's a conglomerate, you know, and on the level of every cell. And that's where it stops. So you never measure individual performance because it does not exist. We have found companies that make this very explicit. Toyota, for example, would never measure or try to even attempt to measure individual performance. Handelsbank and the Swedish bank would not have to. Like Handelsbank, they might have maybe 12,000 people by now. How many teams does that give them? 1,200 or whatever teams or 1,500 teams. So you measure the performance of each of those cells. And the beauty of a cell structure design is that each of the periphery cells, which should be the majority of the teams or cells, it has its own clients, external clients. It writes invoices to those clients and gets paid for the service or the product. Mm-hmm. So all these periphery cells have their own income. It's very different than in an organization where you have a sales department and a production department and whatever other departments, and they don't have their income. In a cell structure, all those teams in the periphery, the mini enterprises, have income. So, and they have like what we would call cost, you know, their own consumption, let's say, and they also pay money to the center to get services from the center, like bookkeeping, for example. So all the cells in the cell structure design have their own income and they can be measured with a profit and loss statement. It's the most intuitive, simple, and also, let's say, market economy thing to do, you know, because what we have in a siloed command control organization is more like Soviet style centralized planning.
Yeah, where you're maybe away from seeing how the market is reacting, right? Each of these cells are maybe shielded from that fact.
Yes. Yeah. Even sales, if you have a sales department or something like that, totally shielded from the market. Mm-hmm. So command and control is fatal for people's ability to understand the market, perceive the needs of clients, for example, and be adaptive. Agile should always have been about decentralization too. Sadly, historically, I also understand why that is. I think the early agilists, they wanted to liberate the teams first and foremost because they saw waterfall as killing everybody's motivation. But then we ended at the team level and we shouldn't.
Yeah, I'd love to stick to this topic of measuring success and measuring performance for the organization. Mm-hmm. So you measure it for the organization, you see it's making losses. What do you do? Do you maybe, you know, look into the different parts of the organization? How do you address that?
Yeah, the best about a cell structure design or about a beta organization or however you might call it, at the time when I started working on this, we called it beyond budgeting organization, but you can call it any way you want. Mm-hmm. Cell structure design is the social technology that we wrote up last year to make this more accessible and easy to share and more open source. So in a cell structure design, every cell will not have a budget or let's say financial allocations, but each of them will have a profit and loss statement. So once you have in a company with 1,000 people, you have maybe 200 or up to 200 of these teams. Of course, they develop a sense of about their income and their cost and so on. You create so much more transparency around the numbers and the figures and the financials than in a command and control organization that, of course, this reality sinks in that, okay, we must have a margin. As a periphery cell or business team in the periphery in an organization with external clients, we must make a margin, you know. And you can also, like what Handelsbanken has been doing for 50 years, you can rank the team between them, not to punish them or not to tell them, those are good, those are bad, and at the bottom of the ranking, but so that teams can recognize what is possible. And one thing that Handelsbank does successively is they tell their managers always, and everybody at Handelsbank knows that key role of managers in such a system is to sit on their hands, to do nothing around these rankings. The rankings are for the teams so that they can recognize where they stand. They compare themselves to the other cells. Like everybody has the, sees the same number, can see everybody's number, can talk to everyone. Teams can help each other. But they also, let's say, they also always have these league tables, as they call it, at Handelsbank, and can see what's happening. There's no pressure exercise. Of course, you should never connect this kind of league table with financial incentives or punishment. That is what Jack Welch did with General Electric in the 80s and 90s. And it's a horrible, vicious way of, you know, always cutting off a little bit more of your organization and punishing people all the time. These league tables, they inform teams about where they stand, no more, no less. And that's pretty tough by itself. You know, you know where you're in business. Mm-hmm.
Is there ever a good idea where the structure is not maybe the ideal fit for the organization's context?
Yeah, that would be like asking, okay, but somewhere command and control would be okay, right? It's like asking, but slavery in Georgia is okay or in Alabama. And if I imagine being Abraham Lincoln, I would say, oh gosh, no, no, that's why we started this war. You know, slavery must go. Command and control must go. Not because I say so, of course. Nobody has to listen to anything that I'm saying. The point is that complexity rules, complexity reigns, and it has done so since the 1970s. It's a reality in every organization. I have failed in the last 17 years, I have failed to meet a company where there's no complexity in the marketplace. So market complexity is everywhere. Even public sector organizations, they are faced with complexity. So since the 1970s, since the oil shock, that has been the case fundamentally, but or globalized competitive markets, they have been natural since the 1990s. And now with since the rise of the internet also, this has, of course, strengthened. But command and control is not only done and dead because of complexity, but also because human beings deserve better. And this is a second point I think we should always highlight, that Scrum and Agile, it's not just better because it's more effective and more complexity, you know, fit for complexity. It's also better because it, in an Agile team or Scrum teams, so to speak, we learn how to deal with capable adults, human beings, in an adult way, in a humanistic fashion. Command and control is utterly inhumane. It's like asking, is there a country in Africa that doesn't deserve democracy? Or do North Americans really need democracy? I mean, they got this 50%, almost 50% voted in Trump in the recent election. So do they really deserve democracy? And I would say every human being on the planet deserves democracy. But of course, it's a sophisticated art. It's much more tricky to run software development in Scrum, I would say. It requires an overall, a higher level of consciousness by everyone to do it. Mm-hmm. And it requires fighting the let's say, the command and control practices that try to sneak back all the time.
Yeah, the regression to the mean, so to say, right?
Exactly. The constant pressure of regression.
In the last episode with Mary and Tom Papadick, I remember talking about, you know, some really good examples of this. Mary had mentioned AWS was a great example of a company that's implemented such a design with some success, right? Where they have these independent teams that are responsible for the value of a specific product and the profit loss margins, as you mentioned. But, you know, a question that comes to my mind is when a cell or a part of an organization is so effective in doing what it's doing, why does it need the rest of the system? Why does it need to be a part of the rest of the living system?
Yes. Oh, by the way, I listened to the entire opposite with the Papadicks, and it was very nice, right? Very nice storytelling. I think you answered only two questions, and he answered four.
Two or three, yeah. Somewhere around there.
Very nice episode. No, really, thanks. Really nice. Yeah. I enjoyed listening. Yeah, why does it make sense for periphery cells to be part of the larger organization? I think it's easy. You know, if you are Southwest Airlines, the individual crew or the individual station cannot run the company. It's not the same as a company. The station is like a subdivision of Southwest Airlines, and the crew or the team would be an equivalent to a cell. Or let's take Whole Foods, which for a long time at least was a great beta organization. The individual market, of course, is not the company. You need something more. You need some people doing the accounting and the purchasing and so for the stores. So the individual team, maybe at Handelsbanken, they put it best, the Swedish bank, Europe's most successful bank for 50 years now, almost. They say it like this: at Handelsbanken, you act like a business owner without really having to own the business. Of course, you are not. If you are a branch, part of a branch team or a branch manager, it's not your bank. Well, you do not own the bank. You own the bank also because you get some shares over time as a profit share through the profit sharing system. But you know, it's of course a larger bank that you act in. But nobody steers you. Nobody tells you what to do. You really must come up with it in an entrepreneurial fashion of what to do. You know, so the benefit of having decentralized organizations is that it's really like being an entrepreneur. It's being part of entrepreneurial teams. I do not think that the future is in everyone being a freelancer. I think that larger companies have their purpose. I do not only think so, I know it can be proven, you know. Freelancing is not all there will be. But there are good reasons why organizations will survive forever until the Mad Max age or so, some doom event. But organizations are fantastic if we can give teams the power to perceive themselves as businesses. And with command and control, that's utterly impossible, of course.
I want to touch on maybe what some of those things are, right? So these central functions that the larger organizations provide for the periphery teams or cells. What are, in your experience, some of those things that are important to be maybe centralized?
Yes, centralized teams would usually provide stuff that decentral teams would not want to do or cannot do. Let's say, usually in a company, in most companies, you wouldn't have a lawyer in the peripheral team, legal services or stuff like bookkeeping, IT stuff. If you are in an industrial company or service company and IT is not your core business, then you would probably need some people in IT who provide whatever, the hardware, the infrastructure, or some programming as well, you know. And that would be stuff by the center for the periphery, and it would be paid for by the periphery. And with all the transparency coming with it, and Handelsbanken, okay, a bank is a highly IT loaded organization naturally. Of course, at Handelsbanken, they have IT teams in the center, and they have these quarterly negotiations about the transaction prices. Every transaction that a branch does with clients has a certain cost associated that is booked to the sales accounting statement, so to say. Yeah. So of course they have strong negotiations about, okay, how can we drive the transaction prices down? And if IT wants to invest in new technology, there's no budget for that. IT has to ask the periphery for the resources so that they can invest. So it's very much like a market economy. You know, you always ask your client for the money. Pose things to the internal or external client so that the client can buy. Marketing the same. There's no powerful marketing function in a decentralized beta organization or cell structure design. But marketing would have to sell the ideas to the periphery. If they buy it, then stuff can be done.
Yeah, this is such a fascinating topic for me. Something I'm new to as well. And I think one of the... The beauty of it that stands out for me is that these peripheries are then empowered to think about the profit loss, to talk to the customer, to do what's necessary. They're empowered to do
even set their own prices.
Yeah.
Set their own prices and so on. There is beauty in this model. And it also requires that, of course, we let go of certain, let's say, functions or traditions that seem natural to us, like product managers or key account managing. Most COO activities these days are just, all that is just steering from the center. Most HR activities would be gone in a beta organization as well, you know, because of course a periphery team would never buy and pay for performance appraisal processes. No periphery cell would ever pay for a budgeting process or anything similar to this performance management madness. These things would be just eliminated. And we are doing this kind of work, you know, transformation work. These practices get eliminated naturally.
I'm curious to hear more about the transformation work that you mentioned. You know, so when you do work with organizations that are maybe not so used to working this way, right, or anything close to it even, with monolith systems, what is your first step and where do you start?
There are different approaches, and let's say the best approach to organizational transformation, if we're talking about a bit larger organizations, let's say more than 50 people, then the best approach today is what we call open space beta. We developed it, Silke and I, Silke Herman, my partner and I, we developed this approach, but it was by no means everything in this approach was invented by us. Some of the, let's say the rough concept, we found it in the work of Daniel Mezick, mm-hmm. an East Coast agilist.
Yes,
Daniel Mezick, he's a brilliant guy. He invented this concept called open space agility. Inviting Leadership as well as his most recent book. And Open Space Agility, what he did with that concept is he made it open source, by the way, so everyone can use it. He found a way of how to, regardless of the amount of IT or software development people that you have, you might have hundreds or thousands, how to help them transform to adopt Scrum or maybe Kanban or anything similar. How to help lots of people adapt agile practices. Do it just in just a few months. Open space agility begins in open space, in an open space meeting format. It ends in open space like 90 or 100 days after that. And in between, everyone is authorized to adopt Scrum and Agile. And all the discussion that is needed to do that has been done in the first open space meeting. So this brilliant idea of time boxing organizational development, that's really Daniel Mezick's idea. It cannot be appreciated enough. It's a brilliant idea, you know. Just like a software development sprint might take naturally like 14 days or something like that, a natural organizational develop or transformation sprint with everyone who's willing in a company, in an organization, regardless of size, it should take about 90 days. So begin in open space, end in open space with 90 days in between. What Daniel, in his work, did was to make this thinkable for agile teams. And when Silke and I looked at that, it was beginning of 1998, we figured, okay, this is nice for agile teams, but this is not about the whole organization changing. How about taking this, as I said, into the realm of beyond budgeting or beta and creating a decentralized organization in those 90 days? Is that possible too? So we, let's say we reworked the whole approach, took some of the more Scrum and specific things out, put some other elements in. We changed the model of roles that Daniel had brilliantly developed. We modified it a little bit. But overall, the overall, let's say, timeline or time frame is the same. You need some time for preparing the first open space meeting, then start in open space and in open space with 90 days in between. And there you do the transformation. And the best thing about it, you know that you will be done after 90 days. The sprint is over. Of course,
you're one way or another, right? Organization.
No, what it means is that, of course, and that's why we call decentralized organizations beta organizations, because they are in perpetual beta. They will be in beta. They will be moving on. Mm. They will be living, evolving systems, emerging systems forever. But the sprint is done after 90 days. That's what there's a certain level of irony in this approach. Of course, nothing is done. Many things will be done. The organization will have changed dramatically. During the 90 days, you need to create the cell structure design that we've been talking about, for example. You need to eliminate all kinds of things. So what we have seen is that companies can get incredible amounts of work done. They come totally transformed out of the 90 days. But of course, things do not have to end there. There is what we call a quiet period.
After the 90 days, there is a period which we call the quiet period. All the external support, external coaching stops for at least 30 days. So let's say the organization has time to level up, and then it can start another chapter of working the organization. So this open space beta cycle of a total of 180 days, it can start again. It's like having another organizational development sprint. So open space beta is by no means supposed to be ending. You can do it forever as a way of the organization learning to do all the organizational development in a concentrated sprint-like fashion by itself, you know, with less and less support from the outside. And it's all created as a light touch approach where you practically, even in the first cycle of open space beta, in the first 90 days, you need very, very little external support, very little. We only found out about Daniel's work 3 years ago. We created Open Space Beta about two years ago, and we've been working we've done it with several clients. And I must say, everything we did until then was just meager and fragile. And let's say the transformation work with conventional approaches of change management or change leadership or the Kotter approach and so on, it always carries the risk of fizzling out, of not ending well. And I myself have seen a lot of these projects where it just doesn't work out. It takes too long. And so once you time box the change and invite everybody very early on in the first open space to join the effort and authorize everyone to do the organizational development in their teams and beyond their teams, then the energy is, the engagement is so much higher than with conventional approaches.
Yeah, no doubt. And I will definitely link where people can go to learn more about Open Space Beta and what that entails in more detail.
Yes, it is free to use. We offer no, there's no certification course that you have to do to use it. Everyone can use it. It's really open source. You are even allowed to develop upon it and improve it, if you like, and then publish the results open source as well. So sharing it with everyone. Developing agile methods with the open source approach in mind and making them open source, I think it's something that we need to be much more consistent about.
I think it's really nice touch because it goes back to what you were talking about, the beta part, where living systems evolve. And so you should have the same thing with your concept, with your practices,
yes,
and have that evolution based on different stimuluses, but different experience and so on.
Yeah, we firmly believe, Silke and I, that social technology has to be free. You know, which is why cell structure design is an open source social technology. People can Google it and find the license, so everyone can use it. Open Space Beta is an open source social technology, so everybody can really make use of it. And there's no, we do not control the use, which is very important, I think, for people being able to adopt these concepts, these approaches.
Great point. So we've talked a bit about, you know, the system in general and the system overall, but I'd like to zoom back down to the cells, the peripheries again. And
yep.
I want to ask you, within a cell, within a part of the system, how is the organization of work done? How do these cells, how do these peripheries decide what to tackle first and where to go from there?
That's an odd question. How does a team within a cell decide what to do and how to do it?
In a typical organization that's not in a cell structure, you have these OKRs, or you have maybe a bit of strategy that acts as this guiding force, right? That tells you, this is what you should focus on. This is our priority for now.
Yeah.
When you take that away, how do you provide alignment for these?
Exactly.
Cells?
Very important what you just said. Our impulse is to think about targets, strategy, plans, incentives, direction, alignment, right? All command and control practices and steering practices. Let's imagine we take them away. What pushes you to do the work? And the answer is very simple. Clients. Clients, or the outside, which for the center is the periphery, which for the periphery, it's the external market and the external client. So this is really what a market economy is about. Ultimately, the client tells you what to do. You make a deal with the client, and then you provide value for the client. That is how decentralization works. It means taking the steering authority away from the bosses and outsourcing the steering to the market. So it's really the clients that tell you what to develop, what to offer, what the service should look like, and what the right price is. Of course, there is always dialogue and negotiation, but that is also a reason why a decentralized beta organization is superior to an alpha organization, because in complex markets, the steering is done by markets anyways. What we currently have in organizations is there are two types of steering, one from the markets and clients and one from the top.
Yep.
And these are not opposed forces, by the way. The centralized steering is usually far less intelligent, and it's detached from reality, because the center cannot know what the periphery, what the market really wants. This is what causes the suffering in organizations with centralized steering. We get detached from market forces. So really, let's imagine a team at Handelsbanken. It gets steered by clients who show up. Of course, I once visited a Handelsbanken branch in West London. We had a conversation with the branch manager, and he said, well, when we founded the branch 2 years ago, we had this and that market definition and said we would serve these and that, those customers. And then we changed it a couple of months back, and now we serve this and that clientele. And they just decided that for themselves. Not that they cannot ask other people in the company about it and consult others, but they have to make that decision.
You know, something else that pops into my head while you were speaking about that is, you know, you have these different points from customers, different needs, right, from the market to each of these peripheries. let's say one of the peripheries decides to create a dashboard to track all these different needs so that they can have a better understanding of what the market needs are, basically. And then if the other cell or another periphery or another team has that same need, do they then reinvent the wheel? Can they maybe collaborate and create one that they both use? How's that?
Yes, that's something that in our, when we help organizations adopt this model, their first impulse is, oh, okay, so these periphery cells, they are all enemies to each other. And that is just a misconception. No, they are not the enemy. The best is to support each other and to help each other and collaborate and help each other out. I think this reflex that we are discussing this question is also a consequence of our experience with command and controls, where, for example, salespeople are driven against each other and incentivized against each other, or where you punish the last 10%. Or the first 10% must get bonuses. And so intuitively, we think that organizations, companies might have or naturally have vicious competition or vicious.
And if I may just interrupt, so the question, the angle I was sort of approaching it from wasn't that of competition. It was from that of avoiding to reinvent the wheel. If you have one team that's acting as an independent business on its own, it's going to do what it takes, right, to understand the market trends, the client needs. Maybe other teams can also leverage it that are part of the system. How do you then encourage this collaboration?
Yes. Well, we found what you would naturally expect. If you have 100 teams in the periphery, or 500 or 1,000 or whatever, or even just 10, if you're a smaller company, then of course you will find that sometimes or often several of these teams have similar or the same problems. Some may not have the problems, but most of them will have certain similar problems or patterns or so on. And of course, once you stop with centralized steering, some periphery cells will invent stuff, create stuff, do stuff differently and in a better way, and they should have the opportunity to share, which is why communities of problems, as we call them, are important. The method, officially, it's called communities of practice, but we find that it's not what communities of cells are about. They are about solving problems together. That's why we like the term communities of problems better. By the way, we define problem not as something negative, but it's something that you cannot ignore. A problem is a thing that you cannot ignore. So not every problem is bad. Some problems can be good. It's not a judgmental thing. But a community of problems, it could mean that in a larger company, you would have a biannual open space for periphery cells to talk about business problems, business interests, business topics. Or you could have certain events for the whole organization, maybe once or twice in a year, so that overarching, let's say, innovation problems are discussed. Yeah. So this kind of creating a community between the cells and connect them informally and with regards to improvements, value creation, that is, it's paramount for a beta organization. But then again, on the other side, you do not need sales conferences, you know, you do not need performance management processes and target negotiations. You do not need performance appraisal. You, let's say, spare people and managers a lot of time. In a strongly decentralized organization, you need certain, let's say, social technologies or practices or patterns to create exchange and bonding and social density, and communities of problems are a way, or consultative individual decision-making. So for certain decisions, you might want to have consultation across the whole organization without having big meetings, but with people consulting each other. So let's say at DM Drogeriemarkt, as you know, a big retail company here in Germany, I think over 70,000 employees by now, they have decentralized many practices as well. For example, auditing for DM, it's not a function, it's not a department, but branch managers audit each other's colleagues. Okay. Branch people audit other branches and so on, which is a great exchange mechanism as well.
Yeah.
So this kind of practice is paramount, you know, beyond the day-to-day work.
Yeah, that's a really cool practice. I think beyond just the rubbing of shoulders with, you know, people who may face similar problems, you're also making that feedback relevant, right? Because you're then sharing things that you're seeing related to the same problem that someone else may have. So, you know, there is this relevance, and you don't have these generic meetings or generic gatherings.
Yes. Also, in the absence of centralized steering and when hierarchy becomes less important, of course, you enable top managers to do much more constructive stuff and to consult others about improvements. Like what the CEO of W.L. Gore, she always says, my job is not to know everything in the company. Most of the time, I help with recruiting. a CEO in a beta organization will be predominantly a recruiter. And do other things, representing the company, of course, as well, articulating certain things. Those are main activities, not steering, not forcing, not aligning. Aligning is also a word from hell, right? People don't align.
Well, Niels, I think as we get to the end of the hour, I want to be respectful of your time. So I have one more small topic that I'd like to get back to that you mentioned really early on that I think is important to talk about, and that's organizational hygiene. Can you tell us more about what that is and why that's important?
Yes, it's an expression we coined. We first described it in our book, Complexitools. It was published in German 5 years ago. It will only come out at the beginning of the next year, I fear. So it has been dragging on forever, but organizational hygiene has really become a core concept for us. It's a complexity tool, which means that it's a practice that requires thinking and acting together. And organizational hygiene means identifying practices that should be eliminated, abolished from an organization. And if you look at it, sounds like a natural idea, but it isn't in organizations. I have found very few organizations that have this kind of practice. I think I've only encountered beta organizations doing this frequently, you know, already decentralized organizations. At SEMCO, for example, another great beta organization beyond the ones that I mentioned, they define their model of running the organization as the absence of certain practices that are normal in other organizations. We don't have them, so that's our model. Our model is not having the bullshit, you know, the budget.
That's a great perspective to have.
So, of course, SEMCO, in that sense, practices organizational hygiene. You must be aware of what you abolished. The problem is also once you abolished certain things, people cannot remember that it was there. At Handelsbank, nobody working there today can remember that they once had budgeting, which is a problem as well. So you must take care that it doesn't creep back in, you know, because people will say, budgeting, what is that? We don't have that. Do we need it? Maybe they will evaluate from time to time if they need budgeting again, you know.
And so, that's fair, right? And they should maybe constantly think about the need for it.
You need to make, it's like our immune system constantly battling certain intruders, so to say. So organizational hygiene is the act of consciously evaluating if you need certain practices that you have and abolishing the ones that you do not need. It's like daily cleansing, daily hygiene, taking a shower for an organization. It means putting certain things in the museum. And of course, the obvious ones I already mentioned, individual targets, bonuses and incentives, budgeting, but also everything associated with waterfalls. I always recommend putting milestones into the museum, abolishing milestones. Yeah, abolishing cost management, abolishing the travel policy. We have developed a poster, a large paper poster, which can be used to, you know, collect the things that should be abolished and work through the list afterwards, you know, so that you can document what you abolished. Organizational hygiene, it's also in my book, Essays on Beta Volume 1, by the way. It's explained what it is. It should be an entirely natural pattern or practice in every organization. Because if you just add practices to your organization, of course, things get inconsistent and illogical. You cannot just add Scrum to your organization. You must also abolish product managers. And this is what marvels me about Scrum. There is no mention of resource planning or resource allocation, which does not make sense. It's conflicting with our individual targets. They are totally conflicting with Scrum. So certain things need to be eliminated. If you want to change, if you want to see a real change fast, the easiest thing also is to eliminate stuff, not to add new stuff on top.
I think it's really useful to do both, right? To check what's being useful and what needs to be eliminated. So you're doing this at shorter, maybe quicker cadences, more frequently? Or when do you suggest teams do this? And how, in your experience, have you seen teams do this?
If you want to approach some kind of organizational transformation, it must be part of that. Otherwise, it will never stick. Whatever you're doing, it will never stick if you do not do organizational hygiene. So in the 90 days of Open Space Beta, every organization will do organizational hygiene. They will create a cell structure and do many things for value creation, but they will also have to do organizational hygiene. If you are a smart company owner, like at your company, you can do it anytime. That's the best thing about organizational hygiene. You can do it anytime, start it anytime, practice it anytime. Performance appraisal. I mean, it's a long dead practice. Everybody knows that performance appraisal is a huge pile of dung and only serves to demotivate anybody. It must be, but of course, you must put it on the garbage heap of history consciously. You must declare it dead and make sure that nobody does it. Otherwise, people will stick to it in some way, or you will just modify it. And if I may add, in these times, we see a lot of toxic practices creep back with new names. We do not have to agree on this, but I would argue that strategic planning is creeping back into organizations currently as canvases. The manifold variations of canvases are nothing different than strategic planning obnoxiousness, or management by objectives, which is setting individual targets and aligning everyone, that is creeping back as OKRs currently. It's a nasty practice. It has never worked, not even at Google. Google is a great company in spite of it having always used OKRs. We don't have to agree on this, of course, but the bad and evil practices from the 1970s, 80s, 90s, they are currently being rebranded with hipster names and hipster marketing. To defend an organization against these practices, it's hard work and it requires organizational hygiene and consciousness, and dialogue, discourse as well.
I think this is such a fascinating topic that I've definitely learned a lot of things during the past hour of our call, of our conversation, but I think this would be a good place to maybe start wrapping up. So I want to ask you if you had any parting comments for the listeners, for the audience members.
Yes, one thing that I have thought about recently, these last few days, read books. Where we were recording this conversation, you just received a book from a colleague, Heidi, right?
Yep.
Of course, having books is a good thing already. Having piles of books is a good thing, but it's also
reading them is better, right?
To read books.
Yeah.
And it might sound self-serving because I write books and publish books constantly, but I don't mean it's self-serving. I think for anyone working in a company, reading books is essential and need not necessarily be business books. It's also good to read something about history or a biography of Abraham Lincoln, whom we briefly mentioned, or history and philosophy are good topics, of course. But I think we read too little, and so our notions are so becoming more and more shallow and superficial. A beta organization must have a higher level of awareness of everyone. A scrum team requires a higher level of awareness by everyone compared to a waterfall group of developers or testers, because good collaboration requires higher levels of consciousness with each other in dealing with each other. And ultimately, to fuel that, we need people reading and practicing philosophy on a certain level, with each other. So yeah, read books. And of course, if people can, you should read Essays on Beta, Volume 1, my latest book as well. To put a little bit of marketing.
Yeah, it's a good plug. Good. I think it's a relevant plug.
Yeah. On betacodex.org, the website of our community, betacodex.org, we also have a long list of book recommendations. I think it has 70 books on it. All kinds of business books that we deem very important, and the choice of books and the books that are not on the list, it might surprise many here.
Great. I will include that in the show notes, the link to that as well. So thank you. And where can people connect with you online and learn more about the work that you're doing, about the Open Space Beta and everything else that we've talked about?
Yeah, I'm very, very, very active on Twitter. The handle is Niels Pfleging, my handle in English. I also tweet in German, but the English handle is Niels Pfleging. And I'm very active on LinkedIn and so on. And we have this community website, betacodex.org, and also Slack group of the Beta Codex Network, if you're interested.
Amazing. Thank you, Niels, so much. I think this is a super interesting topic. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us and telling us about this really fascinating topic.
Thank you very much, Rahul.
Hey guys, it's your host Rahul again. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and subscribe to Agile Atelier Podcast on your podcast app and share this episode with your friends. You can also tweet to us at Agile Atelier. For previous episodes, please visit agile-atelier.com. Until next time.